In the early days of the United Nations, we could count on other countries to go along with what we said. But by now, many other countries in the world just don't agree with us.
You begin to think about what you've done. You took a human life. Now, this weighs heavily on you because you were brought up to respect life.
It's difficult to live in a situation where you see constant injustice and not to want to change that in every way that you can.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, July 17th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown, broadcasting in the studios of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. British Prime Minister Tony Blair arrived in Washington this morning to address a joint session of Congress and meet with President Bush. The two leaders face harsh criticism over the continuing failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and gathering intelligence information that seems to indicate that many of those weapons may never have existed. Blair's visit comes a day after a U.S. soldier was killed in a grenade attack in Abu Ghraib, Iraq, bringing the total number of combat casualties so far to 147, which equals the total number killed during the 1991 Gulf War. General John Abizaid, the head of the U.S.'s Central Command, remarked on Wednesday that U.S. troops are facing a classic guerrilla war in Iraq. Abizaid's comments stand in stark contrast to those of Donald Rumsfeld just 2 weeks ago when the defense secretary downplayed reports of a quagmire and mocked comparisons to Vietnam. The mounting death toll has been the source of harsh criticism of the Bush White House from congressional lawmakers, especially amidst rising estimates of the cost of continuing the occupation, and accusations that some intelligence information used to justify the war was erroneous, some critics say intentionally. Also at issue is a lengthening of soldiers' tours of duty from a few months to more indefinite periods, as U.S. commanders in the region say that the occupation will continue at current levels for the foreseeable future. Appearing on ABC Television's Good Morning America earlier this week, a small group of soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq spoke of poor morale and disillusionment among their ranks. "If Donald Rumsfeld were here, I'd ask him for his resignation," said one disgruntled soldier. Asked by a reporter what he would like to say to the Secretary of Defense, another said, quote, "I would ask him why we're still here. I don't have any clue as to why we are still in Iraq," end quote. The Bush administration's efforts are having a bit more success elsewhere in the Arab world. The so-called roadmap to peace between Israelis and Palestinians continues to take effect, with the tenuous 18-day-old ceasefire still being honored by most of the Palestinian opposition groups. The peace plan, orchestrated by the U.S., the U.N., the European Union, and Russia, aims to end hostilities through the creation of a Palestinian state by the year 2005. U.S. officials and representatives of the Palestinian Authority held a ribbon-cutting ceremony yesterday to commemorate a $20 million U.S. grant for Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas to initiate his end of the peace process with Israel. This is the first time the U.S. has approved direct aid for the Palestinian Authority, and U.S. officials said the grant will go to help restore and improve basic public services in Palestinian areas after they're vacated by Israeli military forces. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is demanding that Israel lift travel restrictions imposed on Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Abbas has been invited to Washington, but he says he won't travel unless Arafat is free to move around. Arafat has been confined to his office building in the West Bank town of Ramallah for the past year and a half. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke earlier this week with Lucy Nusebi, the founder and director of MEND, Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy, as well as Michal Miller, an Israeli from the Truman Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. The two women are members of a 15-month traveling delegation of 6 Israelis and 6 Palestinian women committed to overcoming their differences through nonviolent social change. Their trip to Washington was organized by the International Conflict Resolution Organization, Search for Common Ground. Nusebi and Miller stopped by Peace Watch's studios to discuss their experiences of working for change and their strategies for bridging the gaps that have divided their people for so many years.
I grew up in a Jewish community in Ohio, and I was raised in a community that was predominantly Jewish. It was a public school, but we celebrated Jewish holidays, and all of my friends were Jewish. And part of that culture was Israel. And when I was a child, they took me to Israel, and I saw the country. It was beautiful. I fell in love with it. And after high school, I went on a year program that was full of exciting adventures and real hard work, and it kind of solidified my relationship to the country. And when I had returned to the United States, I went to university, and I studied the closest thing that I could, which was the Middle East. And at that point, it had really become an active part of my adult life. I was involved in student activities at the university, and when I finished, I worked for a group that brought Israeli youth to the United States to travel and to talk to people. And at that point, I was actually supposed to go to the Peace Corps. And I met some people that said, well, why should you go to the Peace Corps? Why wouldn't you go to Israel? You're a nice Jewish girl. Jewish girls should go to Israel. And they found some work for me, and I went. And at that point, when I arrived in Israel, I began to work, and I realized that things were not as had they'd been presented to me, that I had been taught a myth, and I began my activism.
Could you elaborate a little bit? What types of things had you been taught, or what sort of notions had you been instilled with, and how was your experience different?
There was never a critical discussion about the formation of the State of Israel. The Jewish dream was always presented in a very one-sided way. We never discussed Palestinians. It wasn't an issue. There wasn't any question about what happened when the state was founded in 48. Never heard about it. And so these questions, once I start to realize that perhaps there was a whole nother side to the story, a narrative that I'd never heard, began to affect my ability to remain in the country with a citizenship that I got without having to make any effort whatsoever. And I felt a real commitment to that citizenship, that if I'm going to take this on, it's going to be part of my identity and part of my name, that I would have to work for it, and I'd have to work to improve the country and democracy, and to make it livable for everybody who's there.
Lucy Nasebi, you grew up in the United Kingdom. You went to Oxford. You're not a Palestinian, but you consider yourself part of the Palestinian community. You currently live in occupied Jerusalem, and you've married a Palestinian. How did all of this come about?
Well, I met my husband at Oxford. We were both undergraduates there together, and I've known him since I was 19. And it was always clear that he wanted to move back to Jerusalem. He's from one of the oldest Palestinian families in Jerusalem. They're actually so old and so respected that they're a Muslim family who hold the key to the Christian church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is something that they've done maybe for 1,000 years or more. And so they're a family with very, very deep roots in Jerusalem. My father-in-law had been very active in politics. So it was always clear, even before we were married, that my husband would be coming back and living and working in Jerusalem. So I, from when we were first together, started to get involved and interested in what was going on. And I took a degree in Middle East Studies at Harvard while my husband was doing a PhD there. And when we went back to live, we were both teaching in Beer Sheva University, which at the time was considered a hotbed of Palestinian nationalism. It was actually a very, very alive and exciting place to work and to teach. We were teaching history of ideas and philosophy, which was a compulsory course. So we got to know a very, very wide range of the student population. And from that, it was natural to start to really want to work to change things from the better. It's difficult to live in a situation where you see constant injustice and not to want to change that in every way that you can. So I started to get more and more involved.
How long have you been living in Jerusalem now?
I've lived there since 1978. Mm. That's 25 years. It's a long time. Yeah. I have grown-up children who consider themselves Palestinian.
You consider yourself a part of the Palestinian community, but you yourself obviously weren't born Palestinian. What is it like living in occupied Jerusalem as a originally a British citizen?
Well, obviously, it's a little bit different because I have a British passport. It doesn't enable me to move particularly freely, but I think it does give me perhaps an extra sense of protection, whereas I'm aware that Palestinians who are at the mercy of the Israeli occupation forces more than I am. And it's not easy for anyone. It's a very, very difficult situation to move in, to live in. There are risks, even as a foreigner, one takes risks. I have perhaps an advantage or a disadvantage by being a foreigner as well, because I also go to West Jerusalem. And so I can understand perhaps some of the Israeli fears better than people who don't go to the other side. I can identify, I think, perhaps better than many with the problems of both peoples in this horrible conflict.
I'd like to support what Lucy's been saying, but I think that there's something that needs to be added here, that the asymmetry in the relationship between the State of Israel and the Palestinian people is also seen in this this aspect of life as well, that there is a tremendous amount of suffering going on the Palestinian side that is incomprehensible to anybody who has not witnessed it or even experienced it themselves. But on the other hand, the Israelis are now starting to recognize that there is a real cost to the Israelis as well, not only to the economy, but to the moral fabric of the society. It's collapsing. The Israeli economy is on the is really going to a point where the unemployment is soaring. The rates are higher now than they have been ever. That the banking system is going through all kinds of problems. Everything is going wrong, and is a direct relation to what is happening. It's a result of the occupation, and Israel has not yet begun to talk about this. It's not yet on the table of the people who are making the decisions, and the average people in their homes who haven't really understood what occupation means. It hasn't spoken to them yet, and so part of what we do is try to get the message out to people that occupation is not just the problem of the Palestinians, but is the problem of the Israelis. I liked how Lucy had answered the question about having multiple identities in this region, because it is very complex. And I also have another identity. I do integrate into Israeli society, but I also can move freely. I can also call on my American accent and language and demeanor when I want to. And it does permit me to have access to people in places that I wouldn't have as an Israeli.
You're talking about sort of the structural way things are right now and the political way they are, but sort of on a more personal level, how have you noticed that life has sort of changed since the start of the Second Intifada, I guess almost 3 years ago now?
Well, of course, there's the increase in security measures, and I don't necessarily call them security measures myself personally, but rather because they don't really protect anybody. The measures that have been implemented mostly just disrupt life. They don't truly protect us from anything. And in fact, they've begun to endanger us because we now suspect everyone. It's very uncomfortable to be a person that suspects every single person that you come across that they're going to hurt you. It's unhealthy. It's unhealthy to project that onto the other person. It's unhealthy to have that inside of you. I think that the danger that the Israelis feel, that we feel, that we live and experience, I myself have been in attacks, is a result of the occupation, and I don't support the one-sided blame that goes on for Israeli security. Israeli security is linked hand in hand with what is going on. There is nothing to say beyond that.
Mm-hmm. You say that you've personally been in or around when attacks have taken place. I mean, we don't have to go into the details, but do you know of anyone personally who's been killed either in Israeli military incursions or bombing attacks?
Yes. Yes.
And how has that influenced your work as a peace activist?
Well, initially it's shocking and horrible and horrific. There's no excuse for it. There's nothing to say. There's just anger and frustration and sadness. But at some point you have to turn that into motivation to make the situation better. That if nothing will change this, if this doesn't change it, then nothing will. And that we have to use this as our fertilizer because these are the strong emotions that it brings up, and we need to use it positively.
Mm. What about you, Lucy?
Well, I'd like to endorse what Michael said, that, you know, a lot of what is done in the name of security, I think, makes things worse. And obviously, the basic problem is the occupation, is the control that Israel has maintained over every aspect of Palestinian life. I think when you cage an animal, the animal starts to go mad eventually. And if the Israelis insist on caging Palestinians, they're now building a wall that's 8 meters high. That's very high. That's higher than most houses, I think, in the Washington area. They're building this wall on the pretext that it will give the Israelis security. I think that this is completely psychologically wrong, that what they will do is just create more security problems like this, that you cannot mistreat and cage a population and not expect them to try to get out and fight their way out if necessary.
Speak about this group that you founded, the Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy, MEND.
It works primarily with education. We've worked a lot with schools. It was founded 5 years ago to empower Palestinians and to really introduce the philosophy of nonviolence as a way of life and to encourage people to look for alternatives to violence. So we've worked a lot with schools. We worked in particular with girls' schools with a project called Choose a Future, which also included computer training and participatory video training. And we worked, one of our best projects has been with Sesame Workshop. So we have been in charge of all the educational materials that promote tolerance mm-hmm. between Israeli and Palestinian children. And we work with women's empowerment, partly again through the use of video training and active nonviolence training. And in the past year and a half, particularly, we have concentrated on training in active nonviolence and in working to promote nonviolence within the community. We have produced a radio soap opera to promote nonviolence among Palestinian youth. And we have started training groups of political leaders in active nonviolence in a way so that they are now setting up centers from which they will train other people and work within their community. And, of course, we also work a lot with trauma and counseling because there's a terrifying rate of trauma among children. And we've set up about 9 community centers where we also give counseling and trauma treatment.
Mm-hmm. Michael Miller, you work with this group, Maxim Watch, which in English is Checkpoint Watch. It's a women's organization that monitors human rights at the military checkpoints in the West Bank. Speak about exactly what it is that you do.
We are about 150 members, and we go on shifts twice a day, every day, 7 days a week. What we call the rush hour, you know, the morning and the afternoon when people are going and coming to and from work and their regular daily routine. And we try to assist in the movement of the population. We monitor what happens with the soldiers. We write reports. We get involved. We're all women, as you indicated. There's a special force that can be empowered by women, that we are a little bit less threatening than a group that includes men as well, that we can relate to people differently. We're less aggressive, perhaps, and we get involved with assisting people. We help them. We do our best. But, you know, it's mainly also to offer another face to the Palestinians. The Palestinians in the West Bank, they see the soldiers. That is their face of Israel. They don't know that there are other people out there who do care about them and who are concerned about the suffering that they're going through and do know about it. And it also serves as a way that we can document from a civilian point of view what is happening. Now, we can't really attack the policy and the law at the checkpoint because that's not what we're there for. If you want to change the law, you have to do it in the proper place. But what we can do is ensure that it's being followed. We know what the laws are. We know how things need to be handled. We know what they're allowed and not allowed to do. We write it down and we challenge the soldier when it happens. Some of our women have been arrested a couple of times. People have been hit. But mainly we use this as an opportunity to bring to the attention of the military what it looks like from a civilian's perspective of what's going on. And we send our reports. We ask for meetings with government officials. We don't always get them. Sometimes they do give us an audience.
As an Israeli Jew, how are you treated generally while you're doing this work by both Palestinians and members of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces?
The organization was founded at the beginning of the Second Intifada. And at first, they didn't know who we were, and they were very, forgiving is the word with us, very flexible with us. But then when they started to realize that we were not there to support them directly, it became a different story. But over time, we've kind of learned to work with each other in the way that we still get abused violently by them. And accused of everything under the sun, and vicious, all of the frustration. It's kind of another role of that we play is that all of the frustration from the soldier and from the Palestinian at the checkpoint comes out on us because they know we're there to listen, and the Palestinians don't have anybody else in the Israeli public that they can talk to, and so they recognize that we're there to help them, and they let us know what they think of that. For good and for bad. And that's okay. That's really okay. We need to hear that. And the Israeli soldiers let us know what they think of us criticizing them, and that's not okay. But
mm-hmm. What do your Jewish friends think about your peace activism?
Well, as it is with, I think, most people who start to become more heavily involved with this type of work, the other friends that really disagree tend to slip away. I still have problems with people who care about me because it is very dangerous, and we do things that, you know, we are civilians. We don't have protective gear. We are in danger of you know, somebody who wants to make a political statement by kidnapping an Israeli. You know, all of these things, they are realistic, but we say that there's a responsibility for the citizen of Israel to take this into their own hands at some point. Now, we're not going head-to-head with the army. That's not what we do there. But, you know, four women standing at a checkpoint, helping, supporting, negotiating, documenting is what we can do.
Speak about the stage that we're at right now in the peace process. How hopeful are you, Mikhail?
Like most Israelis, I am apprehensive. I think that it's foolish at this point to think that anything is going to happen overnight. And I think that the only real chance that we have, the roadmap is it's a good way to get things rolling. There are no solutions. If you read the roadmap, there are no real solutions in it. But what it does is offer the opportunity for the states and for the populations to take control and ownership of the situation. Realistically, in order for this to work, the civil society is going to have to really engage in this. For now, up until now, it has been that the decisions have been made at a diplomatic level, a military level, and the people on the ground, the average citizen, has not had a whole lot of say in it aside from elections. And so recently we had a poll that came out that indicated that majority of Israelis supported two-state solution, but these are also the same people that elected Sharon back into office. So you have to ask yourself, what is that about? Well, it's about fear. It's not about denying Palestinians their existence anymore. It's about, rather, that how do we build this correctly, that we can ensure our own needs within this process, that we are not destroying all of our own values and aspirations as a nation while encouraging somebody else's. And unfortunately, Sharon doesn't necessarily share those views. And so it's kind of a contradiction that in the Middle East we're used to contradictions, but this is a very dangerous one. And so our responsibility is to get involved, to take ownership, to have institutions of cooperation, NGOs and other social organizations within the society working to support the Israelis in their goal for national, you know, for statehood and for their own security, and that they're not going to lose their home and they're not going to lose a way of life, and helping them to help the Palestinians build their own. And that way it will work.
It It's interesting you speak of potential contradictions. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had faced harsh criticism from several members of his own Likud party several weeks ago by voicing support for the latest Middle East peace effort. He had said, quote, ruling 3.5 million Palestinians cannot go on indefinitely, unquote. And then just a few weeks ago, Israeli soldiers began for the first time to dismantle some Jewish outposts, beginning with Mitzpah Yitzhar. And these have been sort of small, but some have said symbolic and sort of a start to what's, you know, sure to be a long and difficult process. What do you make, Mikhail, as an Israeli, of recent Israeli statements calling for peace, and how genuine do you think they are? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's a start. It has to happen. These words need to be said. Now, what's behind it, I can't tell you. The dismantling of the settlement outposts is absolutely nothing. It's just, it's almost like that the settlement outposts have been built so they can be dismantled, because the real problem are the settlements. The settlements are not being dismantled. The settlements are not really being discussed right now. A settlement outpost is about 10 at most caravans in a little space outside of the settlement. And so what are they doing? They're taking them down and somebody else puts up. I just heard recently that they took down 10 settlements, but within the same time, 11 were put up. So we're up one. So I don't really know. We're going to have a real serious commitment to doing this. And at this point, the United States has to be able and ready to support Israel in the very tough decisions it's going to have to make, and the steps that are going to have to be taken are going to be a little bit painful, but in the long run, they're the healthiest ones for everybody involved.
Lucy, what's the next step? Where do you think we should go from here?
I think we have to work just to deal with the roadmap in its stages. Partly dealing with the questions that Michal mentioned, like the fears of the Israeli public. I think this is one crucial element, because I think that we need to get the public on both sides to take their future in their hands, and that this is a matter of changing some mindsets and really building up trust. The polls have shown that I think 72% on each side consider lack of trust one of the basic problems. This is something that can be dealt with and that can be worked with, and that's a significant majority that could take a peace process forward. I think this is really the next step, to work with the people and bring them on board and give people a chance.
Mikhail, what do you think is the next step?
I agree with Lucy that the two societies have to take charge of this, obviously with their leadership, and their leadership has to recognize and have to include their voices in the decisions that are being made. There's a lot of good work going on out there, but there's a lot more space for it. The message is not getting out to the Israeli public. There is still a tremendous fear among Israelis for their own security needs, for their own national needs, for the continuation of a Jewish state. And that must be addressed, and it must be spoken that the state-building process for Palestine does not negate a Jewish state for Israel. And that when we're talking about securing for Palestinians their rights and rights of return and rights of land and rights of water, it does not, you know, disqualify Israelis from having rights. And I think that this is where the Israeli leadership has been, maybe intentionally, maybe not, getting the message out to the population, that they still feel like it's a zero-sum game, all or nothing, and that there's no room here for some type of cooperation, a real cooperation. We're going to have to take a real critical look at what is happening and to understand it from a different perspective, because otherwise this really could continue. I don't think that there is an end to it indefinitely. And so we have to at some point take it out of the hands of people who are not willing to say the things that we're saying here and to move it forward.
Mikhail Miller is an Israeli from the Truman Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. She's also an active member of Maxim Watch, a women's organization that monitors human rights at military checkpoints in the West Bank. Lucy Nusebi is the founder and director of MEND, Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy. She and her Palestinian husband have been living in occupied Jerusalem for the past 25 years. Miller and Nusebi spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.